very barbarous that's taken place this past week. You did see that on the news. We have two terrorists who came into the vegetable and fruit market in Jerusalem and self-destructed, taking at least 18 others with them. And another blow at Israel. How do you explain this perennial hatred of Israel, of the Jew, that goes on generation after generation after generation? I think there are different ways of coming at an answer to that. But I think one of the more fundamental answers, certainly a biblical answer, is that anti-Semitism is demonically driven. Satan wants to destroy Israel. He wants to destroy the church. He wants to destroy Israel. I think Satan has enough understanding of the plan of God to know that the Abrahamic covenant with Israel demands a physical Israel, a people, the Jew, to carry that out. Now, I need to show you something. We've got to pack in a lot here in the time remaining. So buckle up. We've got to go to work. I want you to turn to Zechariah. Zechariah in chapter 1. And you go on and get your place in Ezekiel in chapter 31 and 32. I've got some pictures I want to show you. I'm going to put those on the very end. But we'll be sure to get the content before we take the pictures. Look at the pictures. All right, get those two places in your Bible. Get Ezekiel 32 and go to Zechariah in chapter 1. I'm going to be brief with this Zechariah passage, but I want you to look at it. Zechariah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Come one back from the last book and you have it. Zechariah is a little book of Isaiah. It's compacted prophetical truth with regard to Israel's future. There is a series of eight visions presented from chapter 1 in verse 7 down through chapter 6 in verse 15. I want us to just look briefly at the first two visions. Verse 7. Let me describe it, because the vision actually begins to be described in verse 8. Zechariah sees a man riding on a red horse. He stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom or in the ravine behind him, and there were red horses, sorrel and white. So they go out in three different directions. You need to understand several the parts of this first vision. The rider on this red horse is a supernatural being. I think that in context, in what he says in verse 9, "Then I said, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel who talked with me said, I will show you. The man that was standing among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And he answered, the angel of the Lord." I understand that to be a reference to the pre-incarnate person of Jesus Christ, a Christophany, the angel of the Lord, and that stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. Now, this sitting still and at rest is not necessarily a good sign. All right, here's the point of this first. It's interpreted from verse 12 down through verse 17. The rider on the red horse is Jesus Christ. The red horse represents warfare. We have red and white, judgment and mercy. We have the myrtle tree. What's the myrtle tree? Israel. The ravine. What's the ravine? That's sort of it is a version of a pit. It's a depression, a down place. It refers there to the suffering of Israel, including the Babylonian captivity, Israel's dispersion today. What this first vision is saying by interpretation, verses 12 to 17, is that God is overseeing the protection of Israel. He will not allow Israel to be destroyed. Now, they'll take a lot of blows, but he is protecting. That's the idea of the reconnaissance and seeing that the world in the condition that it's in and the protection of Israel. Now, the second vision, and I'm having to be very brief here. This is not exposition of Zechariah, just lead into Ezekiel. Beginning at the 18th verse through verse 21, you have another vision. I lifted up my eyes and I saw, behold, four horns. These are probably ram's horns, figurative for power. And I said unto the angel who talked with me, what are these? And he answered, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. The idea here is of an unmerciful sifting, a vengeful action against Israel. I think these horns represent four kingdoms: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. For students of prophecy, you know that the great image in Daniel 2 speaks to that sequence of national powers that's called the times of the Gentiles, where Jerusalem will be dominated by Gentile powers. The head of gold, the arms and chest of silver, and the belly and thighs of brass, and the legs of iron and clay, and the feet, Rome, and revived Rome of the end times. Notice verse 20. The Lord showed me four artisans. These are craftsmen, workers in iron. Or if you will, I'll call them D-horners. D-horners. They're going to remove these horns as powers and threats and deal with them. And I said, what come these to do? What's the purpose of this, of these horn cutters? He spoke, saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head. But these craftsmen are come to terrify them, to cast them out from the horns, that is to throw them down, the horns of the nations which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. So here is Jerusalem under divine protection. There will be punishment of the nations. Now get these two opening visions. The guarantee of God in this vision, in Zechariah, in the closing days of the Old Testament phase of God's plan, promising protection to Israel, Jesus Christ himself oversees that protection, and punishment upon those nations who come in and seek to destroy the nation of Israel. Now, with that in mind, I want you to come now to Ezekiel chapter 30, and I want you to look at a map while you're doing that, 30 and 31 of Ezekiel. I want you to look at the map for a moment and consider the threat that Israel faced, some of the threats. You know, God said in Genesis 12 and 3 that those that bless you I will bless, and those that curse you I will curse. Genesis 12, 3. Cursing upon those who come against Israel and seek to destroy her. The nations surrounding the Holy Land, here we are, the land bridge right here between Africa and Asia and Europe, that the nations, seven of them are mentioned from Ezekiel 25 to 32. Seven of these. And is that not clear enough? All right, let me get it up a little higher. These seven nations are surrounding Israel. Four of these nations can be seen with the naked eye from Jerusalem. We're talking a tight community. Very, very, you know, the Holy Land, Palestine, is a very small stage on which this drama is played out. These nations, let's take in all seven of these nations mentioned, all the way from Ammon all the way around to Tyre and then including Egypt, all seven of these are within 100 miles of Jerusalem. I mean, Jerusalem, Israel is very much aware of this today. We do not have a real appreciation, unless you've been there, or at least studied the geography and have some understanding of the geopolitics of this area, that Israel is in a very dangerous neighborhood. So Israel has been in this dangerous neighborhood and is still in this neighborhood, kind of neighborhood. But what was God doing through the prophet Ezekiel in bringing these judgments against the nations? What? Saying this, that they would know that he was the Lord God. Don't you see that all through this section? If you underline that, you'll see it. It's a theme that just keeps coming up. That they will know that the Lord is God. They will know. They will know. That God is not just some tribal God of Israel. He's not a mascot. Interesting derivation of that word mascot. You know, it comes from a word which means witch. Because at a time before, well, mascots now are rather benign things for the most part. But they were looked upon as giving some sort of, being some sort of a talisman of a good luck charm, be it an animal or a person or a thing. God is no mascot. He is not a tribal God. He is the God of the universe to whom every knee must bow, and there's only one way into his holy presence, and that is through the shedding of blood, the forgiveness of sin, as vividly dramatized in Israel's sacrificial system. And Israel sitting there in the middle of that land bridge with her tabernacle, her worship, the law of God and the prophets and the priests and the whole system, the whole theological system of Israel just reverberating out saying, this is the God of the universe, not a tribal God. And Israel was responsible for communicating that message. And God had another means of drawing attention to his uniqueness, his power, his glory, his majesty. And what was that? Judgment. Judgment here, mentioned in Ezekiel 25 to 32, was a means of evangelism. That they would come to know God, the God of Israel, in seeing his judgments on these nations. Now, with that in mind, we're ready to work now. And I see we have some visitors tonight. So I'm going to, in deference to our visitors, I'm going to walk you, I'm not going to elaborate, but to point out just the high points here, the high point that we've considered in the last few weeks with regard to Egypt. Chapters 30 and 31 and 32 focus upon Egypt. And here we are, 29 to 32. The fall of Egypt, what we're seeing is that there are four conclusions regarding the fall of Egypt in God's plan for Israel. The first is the fall of Egypt eliminated Egypt as a false object of trust for Israel. I will not be able to go back over that. I don't think we're even going to have time for discussion on that, but that was our first point to in pursuit of these conclusions. The second conclusion: the fall of Egypt demonstrated the omnipotence of God. Chapter 30. This was an attempt at drawing out the significance of the day of the Lord concept that arises in chapter 30 and the various uses of that terminology. If you were not here, you get the tape on that, and that will develop initial way the day of the Lord concept. The third movement is that the fall of Egypt, chapter 31, the fall of Egypt displayed the fatal nature of pride. And that's where I'd like for us to look at the present time. Look in chapter 31, and I'm going to show you how this chapter unfolds. It unfolds in the following way. Verses 1 through 9, summary, principal point of these verses. God permits godless nations to rise to great prominence and prosperity. What's happening in verses, what Ezekiel is doing in verses 1 to 9 of 31 is that in order to show Egypt that she is not above accountability to God for her arrogance, He brings forth out of the file, God's file, under A, Assyria, the greatest of all of the ancient nations in terms of empire, in terms of military might, and just sheer raw power and territory conquered. He brings out Assyria, at least up to that point in history. Assyria was such a nation, and she is compared to a great cedar tree. Though it's interesting that a tree would be used as a means of making comparisons. You remember that in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he saw a great tree. And you recall the birds came and nested in, and the animals came and took shade under the tree. And then this tree is cut down, and there's a band of metal around the tree. And well, as the dream goes on, and then as it is interpreted, that tree represents Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldean, the Babylonian Empire, and God cuts it down. It's in that same line of thinking that Assyria set forth here. The extent and duration of national power is determined by God. I think you can see that coming out of verses 1 through 9 in what he says about Assyria. Let me lift a few verses out of this passage just to show you what I'm saying. You will see that in verse 8, coming down to 31 in verse 8, the cedars in God's garden could not match it. No tree, coming further down in verse 8, no tree in God's garden could compare with it in its beauty. Assyria here is likened to a giant tree. It would be the Middle Eastern counterpart to the redwood trees. Imagine a redwood tree next to up one of our scrawny little Georgia pines. Well, Assyria was master of the nations, and in terms of all the trees of Eden, the end of verse 9, which were in the garden of God, were jealous of it. So no tree could rival it, not even those in the garden of Eden. Magnificent. Here is the nation of Assyria. And Assyria, being this comparison being made, brings up an interesting picture of international power at that time. Namely this, that Assyria is cut down because of her arrogance and pride. And you need to underscore this truth because it's come up a number of times through this judgment passage on Egypt, that God has sworn himself as the enemy of all arrogance. And this is the very essence of sin. Why is arrogance, why is pride leading us into what is the very essence of sin? Because I think the essence of sin is demonstrated in the first of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. Idolatry is the essence of sin because it's an attempt to displace God and set the creature in the place of God. Any form of idolatry is that nature. And this displacement of God, the refusal to let God be God, and by Assyria vaunting itself with such arrogance with its own idolatrous system, is the means by which God then brings judgment on Egypt. For Egypt and her arrogance, and Pharaoh claiming to be God and seeing himself as the enfleshment of Horus, the son of Isis and Osiris, claiming himself deity. And yet he knew he had faced his own death and made elaborate preparations for it, as the pyramids give testimony to. You know, we have much excitement has been shown over the tomb of Tutankhamun. You've seen that. Some of you may, depending on your cultural experience, some of you may only remember Steve Martin's song, King Tut. Buried in his jammies, you know. All right, are you with me? Okay, I got you now. And King Tutankhamun was really a minor pharaoh, but how lavishly he was buried. I walked down into that tomb. All of the gold and the finery and the articles, the jewelry and all had been taken and put in, much of it in the Cairo Museum. I saw a lot of it. And the gold throne is just magnificent. I'm saying that for this reason, that the Egyptians here, even knowing that Pharaoh was going to die, but he had the arrogance to claim deity in the face of it all. And God, therefore, in the 8th century B.C. sent a prophet to Assyria. I'm back into Assyria. I'm out of Egypt. Because we got that's what we have in chapter 31. Because Assyria was given an opportunity to respond to God's salvation through the prophet Jonah, probably under the reign of Ashurdan III, 771 to 754 B.C. You have the book of Jonah as a testimony to that. And Nineveh turned by the thousands, to a saving knowledge of God, and it restrained the advancement of evil in Assyria, and she went on as a nation for several generations, until God finally had to bring her down in 612 at the hands of the Medes and the Chaldeans in the destruction of Nineveh. Well, we don't have time to go into Assyria's destruction any further. I want to go back now to what God is saying in verses 10 through 18 in chapter 31, and it is this: that Assyria became proud of her greatness and was cut down by God. That's the point made in this section. See it in verse 10? And its heart is haughty in its loftiness. This then advances along three lines. Here they are. Two, and then an applicational issue that I'm going to delete for time's sake. Assyria received the treatment she had been given others. Now, mind you, this is all brought up about Assyria because the point is Egypt. Assyria's fall became an object lesson of what happens to those that think they're not accountable to God. And that's what Pharaoh, and at this time it was Pharaoh Hofra, in his own arrogance went up, and you know what this is all about, do you not? That Egypt went and appealed to Israel to come over to their side, and through an alliance with Egypt, she could protect her from Babylonian advancement, Babylonian aggression. And what did you? Now we go back to our first study in Ezekiel 29. What was the metaphor that was used to describe Egypt? She was nothing more than a staff of reed, and when you put your weight on it, it breaks and you get splinters, and you cannot put confidence in Egypt. But Israel was addicted to this notion, this fantasy, that she could get her protection from the nations that surrounded her rather than looking to God to provide that protection. I have a point of application there that I'm going to eliminate at this time, because I need to come to the fourth issue, the fourth conclusion that Ezekiel makes with regard to Egypt. And that takes us through 32. Here it is. The fall of Egypt is a witness to the rule of God over human events and the responsibility of people for what they do. Look with me in the first couple of verses of chapter 32, and I'll show you the direction we're going here. And it came about in the 12th year, in the 12th month, on the first day of the month, that's February, March, 585 B.C. Son of man, take up a lamentation over Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him. What's the lamentation? It's a funeral dirge. I want you to sing this funeral song for Israel. And here he launches into it. I'll just show you the movement of it. I won't try to go through it verse by verse, but I want to show you the way it moves. Look with me at the text. He says, you compared yourself to a young lion of the nations, energetic, proud, but yet what? You are like the monster in the seas, and you burst forth in your rivers and muddied the waters with your feet and foul their rivers. Here's what he's doing. He's using two metaphors to describe Egypt. It's in the first place, you saw yourself as a frisky lion out seeking its prey and having your day in the open field. With your armies, you thought you could control your destiny. But you know what? I compare you to a crocodile. That's this monster, I think, to whom he's referring here. And from verse 3 on, here is the picture. God throws his net out upon Pharaoh and the Egyptian people by means of an invading Babylonian army. And he drags this crocodile out of the waters of the Nile, and they've muddied the waters up by their threshing about in the waters. bringing them out of the waters, bringing them up to dry land, and there is this crocodile carcass, huge, enormous in size, and then the birds of prey come and begin to pick and eat and devour, like roadkill, this great crocodile. There's great carnage. You know, just track the I wills through 3 through 7, and you will see where I've derived this principle. I went through the text, and I came to this conclusion, and that's why I stated it this way, that God, look at your notes and fill this in, that this fall of Egypt is a witness to the rule of God. I will, I will, I will, I will. His rule over human events and the responsibility of people for what they do. God was the invisible hand behind the invisible decline and collapse of Egypt. And she is going to self-destruct. Now, this shouldn't surprise us if we know our Old Testament, if we know the Bible as a whole, because the Bible lays, well, let me point you to these two directions. That'll fill this out. You see, this opening point in the verses in chapter 32, in the first few verses here, this is further assurance that God keeps his promises to his people. This is a warning to the family of nations and their leaders that God is not indifferent to the malignancy of pride. Here we are back with this pride thing. Where did I get that? Verse 12. You see it underscored in your Bible. They shall devastate the pride of Egypt. And the foregoing has been a description of the demise of Pharaoh as the sun sets on the once mighty empire of Egypt and the Pharaohs. Now, I was about to say this, that you need not go very far through the Bible and you will find this principle underscored, namely, Daniel 2 and 21. You can write that in the point in your notes at this point. Daniel 2, 21. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. Daniel 4:17. In order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over the lowliest of men. Go into the New Testament, John 19:10 and 11. Jesus said in reply to Pilate, and Pilate said this, "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and have authority to crucify you?" What did Jesus Christ say? This is the same Christ who rode the red horse in Zechariah 1, and who oversees Israel and his people today. Here's what he said. Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin." What was Jesus affirming? That the power ultimately belongs to God to dispense rule and authority and decision-making in accomplishing the purpose of God. All right, now come with me down verses 17 to 32. That God judges individuals and nations for the evil that he lets them do. This furthers the point that I made at the outset. He rules over the human events as well as revealing, this passage reveals to us the responsibility of people for what they do. God judges individuals and nations for the evil he lets them do. Now let's take a few moments and let's move through an issue that is a part of the problem of pain and suffering or a part of the issue of a theodicy. You know what theodicy is? Theodicy is a defense of the ways of God in an evil world, the ways of a good God in an evil world. One dimension to this area of truth is understanding the place of war in the purpose of God. I want to pursue that just for a few minutes. Follow it. Track it here. This passage, and I have a little sidebar before I can pursue this. This passage, if you will look closely at verses 17 to 32, can I have you look there for a moment? Eyes on the text and off the screen for a moment. You will notice some issues that arise in verses 17 to 32. He's going to point out the fact that Son of Man wailed for the multitude of Egypt and bring it down and her and the daughters of the powerful nations to the netherworld with those who go down to the pit. Now, I want to point out in this passage some terms that are used repetitively. They are the keys to understanding this passage. Look at them. You can see the word pit, and you also see the word Sheol used. See the word Sheol in verse 21? See it in verse 27. You may want to circle it. This pit, or Sheol, is referring to the grave, death. He's referring here to the death of nations. Nations obviously include people, the population. Notice also the continual reference to the fact of the uncircumcised. See this? I'm showing you the highlights in this section. The uncircumcised, verse 19. You find it in verse 21. Uncircumcised, slain by the sword. You find it in verse 24. You find it in verse 25, 26, 27, 29. Oh, there must be, in verse 30, there must be something significant about this fact that it's mentioned in this number of times. What he's doing with this terminology, that is, you are going to die without honor. Maybe about all the honor that you will get was that people will be amused by some of your artifacts they see when you go through the British Museum in London. Picture or two of that. We will be amused when you read certain books and see pictures, but you're going to die and you're going to go down into the dust as a people without honor. Your legacy, the curiosity of historians. Now, there are other terms that come up through this section. You see the term slain by the sword. See that? Underscored in red if you mark with colors here. The sword, the slain. Practically every verse mentions this, by the sword, slain by the sword. That's why at this point I've chosen to go after the issue of warfare. God uses war as a means of judgment. War is a consequence of sin. God permits it. In order that men might bear the consequences of their sin as punishment. You have an example of this in our own life, well, in the lifetime of many of us. Nazi Germany was a consequence of sin. Nazi Germany did not happen in a vacuum. It developed over generations. I'm talking about the mindset, the spiritual condition in Germany prior to World War II, that it all culminated in World War II, but it was a process of apostasy and of cultural degeneration in Germany. I have something to which I'd like to refer. I'm reading a book that's comes right at parallel to the subject we are in here in Ezekiel 32. This is Hitler's Cross by Erwin Lutzer, where the revealing story of how the cross of Christ was used as a symbol of the Nazi agenda. And I was taken by this one statement. This is a quote from Viktor Frankl, who is referring to the conditions that existed, the mindset or the philosophy, the theology that resulted in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, in Buchenwald, in Dresden, these places. Listen to what Viktor Frankl said, who survived the Holocaust, and listen to his critique. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis like to say, of blood and soil. I'm absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other in Berlin, but rather at the desk and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. Fascinating study and sidebar on this issue historically. I'm telling you that World War II and what Germany suffered, and many others as well, was a consequence of their sin and punishment that resulted. Number five, God permits war in order that men may see through it and see what sin really is. What war does, let me quote Martin Lloyd-Jones. He has an excellent little book on why does God allow suffering. And it was written pre-war, right in the early, for England, it was written in 39. England was just about, it was in the war. We had not come into it yet. But Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote that book in this context. Here's what he said with regard to war. War reveals man and the possibilities within man's nature. This is what war does, and God turns man over to the experience of his chosen path of disobedience. You know, World War I's also an example of this kind of thing. There was euphoria internationally and with our own nation, but particularly within Europe, optimistic euphoria over man and what the future held, while the world's fairs and the closing parts of the 1800s were just looking to the 1900s as being a millennium. There was theological liberalism had infected a wide area of, had a lot of influence in promoting this optimism with regard to mankind and human nature. You don't have to think long and hard as to what World War I did. It was a war unparalleled in history in its ugliness. It was a hideous in nature, and where young men's chest became target for bullets and the trench warfare and the mustard gas, that was a shattering of the optimistic view of the human race and the human heart. I go further. God permits war to lead us back to Him. That's what's going on here in Ezekiel. I say that it's true through time. God permits war to lead us back to Him. It refines the faith of God's people. What does it do? It exposes apostasy. What does it do? It brings the unsaved to a knowledge of Jesus Christ. Ezekiel 30 and verse 26, and then they will know that I am the Lord. God raised up Pharaoh so that the power of God could be displayed. God's judgment then becomes a means of calling sinners to God who alone is their hope. You know, you can find this illustrated in many, in wartime, in history. The Civil War was an occasion for this very thing. There were revivals that broke out among the Northern troops and the Southern troops in that time, 1861, 1865, that have repercussions even to today. World War II had consequences in terms of evangelism. There was a great wave of missionaries that went out to the ends of the earth at the end of World War II. You know why? Because men had gone, in some cases, saved servicemen, gone into the service, and came back with a desire to go back. I went to school with some of these men who were going to school on the GI Bill back in the early 60s. Even that far along, they were doing it. And went back to the places where they had fought in the war, to Europe, into Asia. And there were thousands of missionaries who went out to the ends of the earth as a result of things that happened during World War II. So God rules in this way to lead people to Him through warfare. And seventh, God used war as a means of disciplining the witness nation when she forsook the covenant. I won't have time to pursue that principle. I have to move to these last two. Wars will increase prior to the second coming of Christ. There will be wars and rumors of wars. Matthew 24 and verse 6, you can expect only an increase in this condition prior to the return of Christ. We may be in a lull in terms of international warfare, but certainly not in terms of terrorism. War takes on many different faces, comes in different disguises, but we can expect an increase prior to the coming of the Lord. It's going to get darker before it gets brighter. But Christ will wage the final holy war at His second coming, Revelation 19, 11 through 21. Now, I want to conclude, summarize. God's judgment against the nations assures us that God will fulfill His covenant with Abraham and that history will end according to God's plan. I think that's the summation of Ezekiel 25 through 32. It was written to encourage God's people that He's keeping His promises. He will see His plan through. Fulfill Genesis 12:3. I will curse those that curse you. Secondly, God's judgment against the nations assures us that human arrogance and pride are an offense to God's holiness. We ought to be in awe of God, not trying to strut our own self-importance on the stage of history, thinking that we're going to solve our problems either through the United Nations or through some Euro market or whatever grandiose plans we have. God is going to bring it all tumbling down to demonstrate the fact that human arrogance is an affront to His holiness. I want to align myself with God in His desires. Do you? God's judgment against the nations assures us that God is the one and only true God for all nations. Not Allah. And by saying that, I could lose my life in a lot of places in this world. Could lose my life even in this United States by saying there's only one true God and He is the God of the universe, the God of Israel, the God of the church. He's not Allah. Nor is He Brahma, the creator God of the Hindus, or Vishnu, the preserver God of the Hindus, or Shiva, the destroyer God of the Hindus. You name the gods or goddesses. There's only one and only true God. That is the God we worship. That is the God that we're sending out. We've got three couples going out with that very message. And now let me pack in here a brief. Well, this is not going to be a balloon ride. This is going to be a jet ride through Egypt. And if you've been along through this study in Ezekiel, this will be just a quick review for you. Yes, thank you. Plug it in there too. Both ends helps. All right, can you get the lights over here, please? All right. Excuse me. Can you get those? All right, thank you. We're going to zero in on Egypt. That's my particular concern here, is to go after Egypt and focus. Does everybody see where Egypt is on the screen? And that land, which is a short distance from Israel, but a vital nation in history regarding Israel, coming into this is the shoreline, the delta region of the Nile as it flows into the Mediterranean. Now, a contrast, I thought a picture of the old and the new might be helpful. There's a modern road of sorts, but there's the old, the desert, the camels, and on the right is a picture of the way ancient Israel and the Egyptians moved about. On the left is the way they're moving about today.